Good day. Today is Friday, 15th May 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Well, today we are in the first day following Donald Trump's visit to China, and he's meeting there with the Chinese President Xi Jinping, who is, of course, also the General Secretary of the Communist Party of China. And in my program yesterday, I spoke about how it seemed to me that the visit, the summit meeting between Trump and Xi had been underprepared, and that I got the strong impression that not much actually would come out of this meeting, that there would be no productive or important announcements, no fundamental or significant changes in Chinese policy, no big deals between China and the United States. And, well, that is exactly how it has turned out. That there's been, by the way, an article about this very thing from Reuters. It says that Trump leaves Beijing with few wins, but warm words for Xi. And it continues, President Trump left China on Friday with no major breakthroughs on trade or tangible help from Beijing to end the Iran war, despite 2 days spent heaping praise on his host, Xi Jinping. And it continues, the summit was filled with pageantry, with goose-stepping soldiers and tours of a secret garden. But behind closed doors, Xi issued a stark warning to Trump that any mishandling of China's top concern could spiral into conflict. And we will return to what Xi Jinping said about Taiwan, because it is indeed very interesting and extremely important. So that's Reuters. They are saying that there was no breakthrough, that there was no major agreements between the United States and China, no great announcements after this visit. Now, prior to Trump's departure from China, one of those very interesting, very revealing articles appeared in the Financial Times, which at one and the same time tells us a great deal and also needs to be approached and handled extremely carefully, because as is always the case, we don't know the full identities of the people who are briefing and leaking this information to the Financial Times. And articles of this kind, which have appeared in the Financial Times in the past, have sometimes turned out to be significantly less than accurate. To give one example, around this time last year, an article appeared in the Financial Times claiming that President Putin had informed the Americans, Witkoff to be precise, Steve Witkoff, that Russia was prepared to freeze the conflict in Ukraine on the then existing front lines, something which would have left places like Guliapolye, Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, and other places which are now under Russian control, under Ukrainian control. I said at the time that that didn't look to me as if it was remotely likely, and that the article appeared to have been published by somebody who was trying to shape the dialogue. And sure enough, it turned out that President Putin promised no such thing, either to Witkoff or to Trump, either then or later. We will come back to all of this later in this program. But what about this latest article by the Financial Times, which, as I said, does need to be handled with great care? Nonetheless, it is, in my opinion, very interesting and very revealing. It says that its title is Donald Trump's Allies Pin Hopes on Xi Jinping to Defuse Strait of Hormuz Crisis. Summit comes as oil supply shock has triggered a worsening energy crisis and threatens Republicans' midterm prospects. And then we go on to read, Donald Trump's allies are pinning their hopes on his summit with Xi Jinping to yield a breakthrough in the Iran war as a spiraling energy crisis the conflict has triggered threatens Republicans' midterm prospects. But then he continues, China's president has, however, given no indication that he will help the United States reopen the Strait of Hormuz, the vital waterway that has been mostly closed since Trump launched the war alongside Israel in February. But Republicans, concerned about their party's election prospects in November, say Beijing's close ties to Tehran and dependence on Iranian crude is an opening. And then we have a comment, and it comes from Republican Senator Steve Daines, who spoke to the Financial Times. It would be in China's best interest, given that about a third of their oil comes through the Strait of Hormuz. Daines said he was optimistic after meeting China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi last week, literally the day after Wang met with the Iranian Foreign Minister. And then we have another Republican senator, Kevin Cramer. There's a lot of hope pinned on Trump's trip right now to China. A third Republican senator, none other than our old friend Lindsey Graham, is then quoted as saying, of all the countries on the planet, China would have the most influence of ending this war if they chose to. We then go on to read that US Secretary of State Marco Rubio said discussions about China's role in ending the conflict would be a key objective in Trump's talks with the Chinese president, saying Beijing could play a more active role with Iran. The Financial Times article continues, energy experts warn that without a resolution for the strait by next month, which is to say June, critically depleted reserves could drive a broader wave of global shortages and price increases. And then we are told that Xi Jinping, over the course of the trip, did make clear China's opposition to the militarization of the strait, but this could extend to encompass the US naval blockade of Iranian ports, and then analysts noted the absence of detail. And we have Dennis Wilder, former head of China analysis at the CIA. It is striking that Chinese readouts thus far do not mention the agreements on a non-nuclear Iran and opposing Iranian ownership of the strait. The lack of comment from China raises questions about whether Xi Jinping really told Trump that he will do whatever is necessary. And then we have a further comment from Ali Vaez, an Iran expert at the International Crisis Group, who says that China has little incentive to intervene, given that the conflict drains US power and credibility whilst strengthening Beijing's strategic position. Historically, Iran has been an exceptionally useful piece of leverage for China against the United States. This has been said by Ivan Medeiros, a former advisor to President Obama. And the article continues, Beijing also appears to have secured energy supplies in the Gulf in recent days amid a trickle of traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. More than 30 vessels have crossed the strait since Wednesday in coordination with Iran's navy, Iran state television reported. Fars, the Fars news agency, which is an Iranian news agency, reported that some Chinese vessels were authorized to transit the waterway as of Wednesday night. And Ali Vaez, the expert, then tells the Financial Times, by agreeing to let Chinese tankers through, Iran seems to have preemptively neutralized Trump's ability to engage in horse trading with China on opening the strait. So, an interesting article overall, because it suggests that for the Republican Party, for Donald Trump's key supporters in Washington, for people, including, interestingly, no less a person than Lindsey Graham himself, the key objective of this meeting, the visit by Trump to China, the only real purpose of this trip was to get the Chinese to put pressure on the Iranians to open the Strait of Hormuz. And, well, I could say straight away that there is not a scintilla of evidence that the Chinese have agreed to do anything of the kind. As the former CIA expert said, if you go to the Chinese readouts, there's virtually nothing, in fact, about Iran at all. No sign that China is prepared to put any kind of sustained pressure on Iran. And for the record, claims that the Iranians suddenly are allowing ships with oil destined for China to pass through the Strait of Hormuz over the last few days in order to preempt any discussions between Trump and Xi Jinping are wrong. The Iranians have been extremely careful to allow ships that are connected to China and Russia, and specifically ships that carry oil destined for China. The Iranians have never placed restrictions on those ships. The only party that has attempted to interfere with that seaborne trade between Iran and China has in fact been the United States, which on one or two occasions has taken action against tankers engaged in this trade, but which overall has not done so. And there it is. There has been nothing. The Republican Party, the people in Congress, other US officials, Trump himself, apparently lobbied China, lobbied Xi Jinping to get China to agree to put pressure on Iran, to force Iran to open the Strait of Hormuz. And the Chinese responded politely. They apparently told the Americans, yes, we also would like to see trade resume through the Strait of Hormuz. We are in agreement with you about that. But importantly, vitally, they committed themselves to absolutely no action. And they not only did not commit themselves to any action on forcing open the Strait of Hormuz, but they failed Trump on various other things. Trump brought with him an enormous delegation made up of business leaders. The Chinese, by the way, in their commentaries about the American delegation, noticed something very interesting in that on previous trips to China, US presidents have certainly brought many US businessmen with them. Mostly, these have come from the energy, aerospace, and car industry and chemical sectors. In other words, the big, heavy industry part of the US economy. This time, they came predominantly from the tech sector. NVIDIA, Apple, Elon Musk, people like that. But there is no word of any big deals. And critically, Trump, before the trip, floated the possibility that the Chinese might make big purchases of Boeing aircraft. He spoke at one point of China committing to buying up to 200 Boeing civilian passenger jets. And the US was also looking for Chinese commitments to ramp up purchases of beef and soybeans. And, well, I have seen no announcements about any of this. Certainly, I have seen no announcements of the Chinese committing to buy any Boeing aircraft from the United States. Certainly not 200. As of the time of making of this program, none at all. And to be frank, I would have expected that if a deal of that kind was in the works, it would have been announced by the US and China together in joint statements during the visit. And the fact that it was not suggests to me that, again, the Chinese probably responded politely to any proposals for these kind of deals, but in the end refused to commit themselves to them. In the absence of anything really substantive, what we got instead was tourism. Xi Jinping took Donald Trump to the Temple of Heaven. By the way, an absolutely extraordinary building, or rather complex of buildings in Beijing, at least as important, in some ways more important than the Forbidden City, just to say. And to my architectural and aesthetic taste, even more beautiful. But anyway, Xi Jinping took Donald Trump there. The importance of the Temple of Heaven in Chinese culture and history cannot be overstated. Something which Xi Jinping attempted to explain to Donald Trump. Whether he was interested, I don't know. Even more interesting, Xi Jinping took Trump on a tour of Zhongnanhai. Zhongnanhai, which translates as the Middle and South Seas, is part of a large complex of parks and palaces with large lakes that were established during the imperial period. The northern part of this complex, Beihai, which is the North Sea, is now Beihai Park. It is a public park. The central and southern sections are now a very tightly secured compound where, since I believe 1950, the Chinese government and the Communist Party of China are located and have their headquarters, and where some Chinese officials have their residences, though not, I believe, Xi Jinping itself. It is considered a great privilege for a foreign visitor to be granted access to it. Xi Jinping gave Trump a brief guided tour, obviously a great act of courtesy. Chinese leaders usually meet foreign visitors in an entirely separate public building, the Great Hall of the People. For the record, my guess is that the reason the Chinese decided to admit Trump to Zhongnanhai is because Putin, who is coming to China in a few weeks' time, has been a regular visitor to Zhongnanhai, and probably when he does come to China, he will be received there again. And the Chinese might have calculated that not giving Trump a tour of Zhongnanhai might be construed as too obviously favouring the Russian leader over the American. But anyway, that is a guess, and it may be that there were other calculations as well. But as I said, mostly tourism. There was also a banquet in the Great Hall of the People. But little in the way of substantive business. And I won't say a point-blank refusal from China to commit to trade deals or to put pressure on Iran, but rather China just deftly sidestepping American demands and refusing to commit to them. Now, this is, in my opinion, important, and it brings us to an important fact about the state of global diplomacy at the present time. When Donald Trump was reinaugurated president on the 20th of January 2025, there was a period of about 6 months in which both the Americans and the Chinese negotiated and dealt with him and his administration actively. They remembered their previous interactions with him during his first term. Both the Russians and the Chinese far preferred working with Trump to either Trump's predecessor, Barack Obama, who both the Chinese and the Russians found unbelievably arrogant and aloof, and to his successor, Joe Biden, who both the Chinese and the Russians found impossible. But then, around the early autumn of 2025, things began to go wrong. In the case of the Chinese, it was the apparent decision of the United States, of the administration, to go back on agreements that had been made with China in May 2025 to end the tariff war. The United States responded in September after further apparent agreements with the Chinese by massively expanding the number of Chinese companies that were subject to US sanctions. The Chinese saw that as a major breach of faith. They immediately imposed extremely tough restrictions on the exports of rare earths. The United States backed down. There was a very uncomfortable meeting between Trump and Xi Jinping in South Korea in October. But I've never got the sense that the relationship has ever improved since then. In the case of the Russians thought that they'd come to some kind of understanding with Trump about Donbass, definitely, about the wider issues of Ukrainian settlement, probably, about a renegotiation of the security architecture of Europe, probably also. They thought they'd agreed all of that with him during the Anchorage summit. They then saw Trump delivering on none of those things, tightening sanctions on Russia instead, imposing sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft, and floating ideas about supplying Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. And after a series of contentious calls, we had the further disastrous episode of the drone attack on the Valdai residence at a time when Putin was stuck in a call or a series of calls with Donald Trump, which many people in Russia, perhaps even Putin himself, were intended to set up Putin as a target. And on top of all of these things, we have seen the United States, since late autumn, go on a sort of rampage, kidnapping the president of Venezuela, imposing a ferocious oil blockade on Cuba, and disastrously, and most importantly, launching another aggressive attack on Iran, killing Iran's leader and many other members of the Iranian leadership, and doing all of that even as negotiations between Iran and the United States were underway and appeared to be going well. And I think that over the last few months, since these events, the Chinese and the Russians have quietly come to a series of decisions which I strongly suspect they have discussed and agreed with each other. Firstly, they will not slam the door on Donald Trump or on his officials. If Trump telephones, they will speak to him. If Trump says he wants to visit their countries, they will receive him. If Trump says that he wants to bring his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, along with him, they will allow Trump to bring Marco Rubio with him, even to China. And even though China has imposed sanctions on Marco Rubio. By the way this was done by the Chinese over the course of this visit is extremely indicative of what I am about to say. Because though the Chinese allowed Rubio to come, they didn't lift the sanctions on him. What they did was they simply changed the spelling of his name in Chinese characters. So Marco Rubio, according to the original spelling of his name, continues to be sanctioned. and cannot come to China. Marco Rubio, in accordance with the spelling of his name, as of the last 2 days, the different spelling of his name, could. It's as if the Chinese are indulging themselves in the fiction that there are two completely different people called Marco Rubio. The key takeaway of this is that, yes, they're not going to stop Marco Rubio coming to China if he comes there in Trump's company and if Trump asks the Chinese to admit him. But neither are they going to lift their sanctions on him. As far as China is concerned, he continues to be persona non grata. And they can, of course, revert to the original Chinese spelling of his name at any time. So the Chinese, the Russians, they will speak to Trump, they will meet with Trump, they will receive Trump, they will have continued interactions with the American administration, they will preserve diplomatic contacts, they will be careful to speak politely about Trump, but they're not going to deal with the United States substantively for the time being. They are not going to continue negotiations to settle the conflict in Ukraine. The Russians have said that those negotiations are now indefinitely suspended. The tripartite negotiations between Russia, Ukraine, and the United States, they've been kicked by the Russians indefinitely into the long grass. The Chinese will receive Trump. They'll be polite to Trump. They will show him Zhongnanhai and the Temple of Heaven. But they will not commit themselves to agreements with him. They won't even negotiate substantively with him on the pressing issues that matter for Trump and for the United States at this time, specifically the conflict in Iran. The Russian and Chinese calculation appears to be that not communicating with the United States, given the power of the United States, is dangerous, that it is particularly dangerous when dealing with a president as volatile and as unpredictable and as the Chinese and Russians probably say to themselves and each other, as unstable as Donald Trump is. So they will meet him, they will humour him, they will be polite to him. They don't want him to throw a tantrum and do something that might be so dangerous that the Chinese and the Russians are forced to respond to it in ways that they don't want, but neither will they deal with him or engage him or his administration in any long-term issues. They don't trust him. They don't trust his administration. They don't believe that they are agreement capable. And as I said now in several programs, I think that they probably also think that he's not, the administration is not even negotiation capable either. This is a unique situation in international relations. China and the United States have conducted an active, intense, at times very productive dialogue with each other ever since Nixon went to China in 1972. Indeed, ever since Henry Kissinger went to China secretly in 1971, Xi Jinping actually reminded Trump of all that history during his visit. He talked about it at length in his speech at the banquet at the Great Hall of the People. But now it is different. Contacts will continue, yes, but movement on substantive questions, no, because the Chinese don't believe that the Americans can be trusted. And it is the same with the Russians too. Putin will talk to Trump. He will exchange pleasantries with Trump. He will give warnings to Trump, as he did a few weeks, 2 weeks ago, when he warned Trump against resuming the war, the military part of the war against Iran. And as we know, when he warned Trump about possible massive retaliatory action by the Russians against central Kiev in the event of a Ukrainian drone attack on the Russian Red Square parade on Victory Day on the 9th of May. But Putin is not prepared to go further to discuss arms control, economic contacts, the details of the negotiations over Ukraine, or anything like that. So I think this is an important moment in international relations. Again, in terms of the Russians and the Americans, I don't remember anything exactly like this before. Now, I mentioned that over the course of Putin's last call to Trump, Putin gave Trump two warnings that in both cases involved an implied threat. One was his warning against any renewed military action against Iran. And as I have pointed out, the Russians are in a position to make good their threat on this because, as is now universally acknowledged, they are an active provider of intelligence data and military material and other things to Iran, something that the Americans unquestionably know. And of course, Putin also gave that other warning about an attack on central Kiev in the event that the Victory Day parade were attacked by Ukraine. And again, Trump and the Americans would have known about the enormous retaliatory power that the Oreshnik missile now gives the Russians. So the Russians, over the last 2 weeks, have given the Americans warnings backed by threats, which up to now the Americans are heeding. What was interesting about Trump's visit to Beijing is that Xi Jinping gave a similar warning backed by threats to Donald Trump, and he did so in public. And of course, the topic was Taiwan. And I am taking this now from the Chinese readout of the meeting between Trump and Xi. It comes, by the way, with a photograph in which you see the two delegations meeting in the one of the major halls in the Great Hall of the People. So Xi delivered this warning, not just privately to Trump, but in the presence of the entire American delegation, Marco Rubio as well. And this is how the Chinese Foreign Ministry reports Xi's words in the readout of the meeting between Trump and Xi, which the Foreign Ministry has provided. President Xi stressed that the Taiwan question is the most important issue in China-US relations. If it is handled properly, the bilateral relationship will enjoy overall stability. Otherwise, the United States and China will have clashes and even conflicts. And conflicts is clearly a threat of military action, direct military action by China against the United States itself, putting the entire relationship in great jeopardy. Taiwan independence and cross-strait peace are as irreconcilable as fire and water. Safeguarding peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait is the biggest common denominator between China and the United States. The US side must exercise caution in handling the Taiwan question. Now, the key word here in this readout is must. The US side must exercise extra caution in handling the Taiwan question. It's not just a request, it is the starkest demand made of the United States by another country that I have seen or seen reported by that other country. Xi Jinping is telling Donald Trump and the United States what they must do. And, well, we see that the Chinese readout says that if the relationship with Taiwan is mishandled, there might be armed conflicts between the United States and China, which would put the entire relationship in great jeopardy. But Chinese newspapers and publications, in place of the word jeopardy, have translated the word as danger, putting it in great danger. So there it is. It's the strongest warning from China to the United States that I have ever seen. Just as the Russians have made direct threats against, well, the United States over Iran, in a conflict of which the Russians are, in effect, a third party. So China has actually threatened the United States with something that approximates to outright war unless the United States behaves itself in the way that China says it must do. I don't know how Trump responded to this. I don't know whether he understood the full force of the warning the Chinese gave him. I don't know how this is understood or reported in the United States. But as I said, I have never myself seen any country, any leader of a country directly threaten the United States in this way. Now, of course, Xi Jinping says this about Taiwan. Notice that Xi Jinping says that this is the most important issue for China in the relationship between China and the United States. Xi Jinping is telling Trump that for China, the question of Taiwan is more important than trade or business relations or any of those things. Whether the United States accepts the message, understands the strength of the warning, I, of course, cannot say. But I come back to my main point. The Chinese, over the course of this trip, gave the Americans nothing, just as the Russians are no longer cooperating or working with the Americans on Ukrainian peace. And just as the Russians have recently given warnings to the Americans, backed by threats, the Chinese, as we see from this readout, are doing the same. Now, I think that this does need to be understood in the United States. They need to understand that in the conflict with Iran, the United States is essentially on its own. China is not going to come to the US's assistance over Iran unless the United States fundamentally changes its approach and decides that it is going to engage in serious negotiations, which the Iranians can be confident about and which will eventually secure long-term peace in the Persian Gulf. If the Americans were to adopt that kind of approach, then I suspect that the Chinese and the Russians, in their own interest, would indeed be helpful. But so long as the United States, as President Trump, continue to make impossible demands of Iran, that it basically do away with its entire ability to enrich uranium, effectively abandon its energy programs, open the Strait of Hormuz without obtaining any kind of guarantees against future attack. Well, so long as that remains the American position, then the Chinese are not going to shift and they're not going to help the United States out of its current difficulties. Lindsey Graham might say that China has huge influence over Iran. I believe, as a matter of fact, that it does. But China is not a switch that the United States can turn on and off whenever it chooses. China has its own policies and its own ideas, as does Russia. simply because the United States has got itself into trouble in the Persian Gulf and with the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. That doesn't mean that China, which perceives now the United States as an adversary, is going to come to America's rescue. So there it is. It remains for the United States to decide what it is going to do about Iran. It's still got very difficult decisions to make. Well, I say that, in my opinion, the decisions are very straightforward. The United States should sit down and negotiate with Iran and do so in a realistic way. And in a post on X and in an article I've published on the Duran Substack site, I've explained the kind of approach which, in my opinion, the United States might fruitfully take. So I don't actually think it's complicated or difficult. But of course, if you see things differently, if you say that you must win and you can't allow Iran to win or even gain a draw, if you approach everything in zero-sum terms, as people like Senator Lindsey Graham tend to do, if you make out that your opponent is the worst and most evil government on planet Earth and should not really be, properly speaking, negotiated with at all, if you think that killing the leaders of that government is an entirely worthy and proper thing, well, I suppose accepting that you must negotiate with the leadership of a country that you are describing in that way and treating in that way, then I suppose it is difficult. But until the United States grapples and accepts that difficulty, the situation in the Persian Gulf will remain as it is, and all of those Republicans who are now becoming worried about the fact that energy prices are rising and this is putting pressure on the American cost of living, and indeed inflation, consumer inflation in the United States is now running at 3.8%, and the cost of inputs into the US economy is now running at 6%, all pointing to higher inflation still. Well, all of those people who worry about these things on the Republican side need to start understanding the realities. They can go to war, and that, in my opinion, will be a disaster, or they can swallow the pill, sit down and talk, and then perhaps the Chinese and the Russians might help them. In the meantime, even as President Trump returns to the United States and now must make these decisions about what he's going to do with the conflict with Iran, he must also continue to grapple, as must the Europeans, with the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. And that crisis has received less attention over the last few weeks, mostly because of the crisis in the Persian Gulf and because most governments in the West are now mostly focused on the deteriorating situation in terms of energy prices. But the reality is the war goes on, and it is, in my opinion at least, as consequential in the long term as what happens in the Persian Gulf. And of course, Western governments at the moment are going through, as I've discussed in other programs, that periodic stage that they often engage in of comforting themselves that all is well, that the situation on the front lines is fine, that the Russians are stalled and are not advancing, and that for the moment at least, Ukraine has the upper hand. None of those claims, as I've also pointed out in many programs now, none of those claims are actually true. But of course, it is what people want to believe. It's what the media across Europe have been told to say. It is what they do say. And I don't know to what extent European leaders themselves believe these comforting myths. But for the moment at least, it's avoiding the need, it's preventing the need from making any difficult decisions, which is what I suspect this narrative is mostly about. Difficult decisions about direct intervention in the war, undoubtedly sought by some, or negotiation with the Russians, also talked about by others. But let's first of all turn again to the actual situation in the war itself. And I will begin here with an article in the New York Times, which confirmed that which I have been privately hearing about for a long time, and which I remember mentioning for the first time in the autumn of 2024, shortly after the first missile strikes using ATACMS and Storm Shadow missiles, which were launched by the West and the Ukrainians against targets inside Russia, in Kursk region, as it happens, though the attacks subsequently were expanded to engage other targets in other parts of Western Russia as well. Now, at the time, I mentioned that the Russians, soon after that strike, carried out a strike with an Oreshnik missile on the Yuzhmash factory in the city of Dnipro. And I also mentioned that it seemed as if the Russians had conducted a strike against some kind of headquarters or, anyway, facility where Western advisers were known to be present. But lastly, I mentioned that the Russians seemed to be in the process of conducting strikes against Western and, in particular, American economic interests in Ukraine. Well, it seems that after President Trump was inaugurated, this pattern of attacks abated. President Trump gave an interview in which he said that he vehemently opposed missile strikes inside pre-2014 Russian territory. And it seemed for a time that this extremely disastrous plan, project, was being abandoned. And then later in the late spring, early summer of 2025, we began to see the ongoing Ukrainian drone offensive against Russia resume. There were attacks on refineries, Russian refineries across Russia. There were attacks, on Russian refineries across Russia. And of course, that Ukrainian offensive was undoubtedly facilitated with intelligence and material assistance provided by the United States. That was actually acknowledged in articles in the New York Times. And of course, the drones themselves are mostly made in Europe now. So the West has been heavily involved in this Ukrainian drone offensive against Russia. And an article has now appeared in the New York Times, which says that at around the same time that the Ukrainians resumed this drone offensive against Russia, the Russians in turn resumed their attacks on American economic targets across Ukraine. And that those attacks appear to have escalated, and apparently American business leaders whose warehouses and industrial plants and other facilities in Ukraine are now regularly attacked by Russian drones. Anyway, they have now apparently spoken about this to Congress. They said that it's clear to them that these attacks are intentional, that the Russians are systematically going after American economic interests in Ukraine. And, well, this has been an escalating issue since at least, it seems, late spring, early summer of 2025. And I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that a Russian combined drone and missile strike on the port of Odessa appeared to have been directed at a major port facility which was known to have partial or indeed entire American ownership. And I said that this did seem to be a significant escalation by the Russians, except that we can now see that it isn't so much an escalation, but rather a pattern of the Russian attacks in Ukraine, which are now taking place. And one of the things that is making this Russian offensive against American economic assets and interests across Ukraine possible is the massive production of Garand drones. Obviously, it would make no sense, no logistical or military sense, to launch a cruise missile against a warehouse containing goods that are probably mostly related to civilian needs, simply because that warehouse is American. That would be a grotesque misallocation of expensive resources, cruise missiles being expensive equipment which require complex processes of fabrication. But Garand drones are a different matter. Using Garand drones to hunt and destroy American economic assets across Ukraine is a commercially viable proposition. It's likely that the cost of one of these drones costs less than the items stored in any particular large warehouse that is attacked. And my guess is that this really got underway on a big scale last summer, and it has escalated steadily since. And the business people apparently told Congress that their impression was that the Russians are now working to drive American business out of Ukraine. And I'm going to make a guess that they are succeeding. Now, back in the winter of 2025 and spring, there was an enormous, ultimately irrelevant story, as it had turned out, between the United States and Ukraine. Zelensky had made a very foolish speech in which he spoke about the trillions of dollars worth of strategic minerals and rare earths, which supposedly were available for exploitation in Ukraine, and suggested, this is in the autumn of 2024, and suggested that all of these strategic minerals and rare earths would ultimately ensure that the United States would be fully paid back for the costs of the war. It turned out that in reality, Ukraine's actual mineral and strategic resources were far less, orders of magnitude less than President Zelensky was saying. But Donald Trump predictably took the bait. He insisted that Ukraine sign a mineral rights exploitation agreement. There was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing about this. Zelensky initially balked at the idea. He resisted signing this agreement on the basis of the original suggested American terms. Eventually, he got the Americans to agree to some significant changes, and the document was signed and eventually ratified by the Ukrainian parliament, except we've heard nothing about the matter since. And we now can see why. Not only are many of the most valuable deposits, mineral deposits, already under Russian control, including the famous lithium deposit that at one time we were hearing so much about, but for American business people investing in Ukraine whilst the war is underway is a dangerous losing proposition. If they build up factories or establish warehouses or create commercial premises, the Russians now have the capability to destroy them. There continues to be a persistent narrative that the Russians do not enforce their red lines. The fact that the Russians began the special military operation at all, to my mind, strongly argues against that persistent meme. But over the last few months, we've seen that the Russians do take action when their red lines are breached. When missiles were launched into Russia, the Russians appear to have stepped up their assistance to Iran. And the fact that this assistance is being provided is today, I think, universally acknowledged across the West. Though, of course, hell would freeze over before anybody in the West, any media outlet in the West, or commentary in the West would acknowledge that fact. Even though the linkage, to me at least, looks obvious. And of course, the Ukrainians did launch drone attacks inside Russia with the assistance of the United States. And now it is American economic interests across Ukraine which are being attacked and destroyed in retaliation. People in the United States are losing money over this. Well, there it is. That's one little thing I wanted to point out. I don't suggest that it changes the whole situation in the war, but it's not something to ignore. Now, back in the late summer of 2025, I was talking about scenarios where we might have 1,000 nights or days when the Russians were launching 1,000 drones, Geran drones, against Ukraine simultaneously. I thought that might happen in the winter. It didn't actually happen in the winter, but it's been increasingly happening over the last few weeks. And well, over the last couple of days, it did actually happen. Zelensky himself admitted that the Russians launched over 1,000 drones over the last few days, over the course of a single 24-hour period. And this was part of a larger sequence of attacks that has also taken place across Ukraine, carried out by the Russians using both Geran drones and other drones, but also, of course, missiles, cruise missiles of various types. Now, there is much speculation that the Russians were able to do this because they were able to stockpile drones over the course of the 3-day ceasefire period, which may very well be true, by the way. But it does show that the Russians do have the ability to conduct attacks on Ukraine, in which they launch over 1,000 drones, and in fact, in this case, it was well over 1,000 drones against Ukraine over the course of a single day and night. They have the ability to coordinate and organize these attacks, and that when they do, the Ukrainian air defense system, to the extent that it still functions, very quickly becomes overwhelmed. Now, the Russians are expanding, continuing to expand their Duran, their sorry, their Geran drone production facilities. So, even if it was true that the Russians carried out the attack on this scale because they'd stockpiled drones over the ceasefire period, it seems to me that we are now, anyway, moving much faster in that direction. And, well, for the record, my own theory as to why the Russians didn't do it over the winter is not because of shortages caused by production shortages or because of weather conditions during the winter or anything like that. It is because the Russians still had not fully coordinated and worked out the technological challenges of coordinating and guiding all of these thousands of drones simultaneously towards their targets. Clearly, they've been working on this. I discussed in a recent program that we now have a situation where drones, Geran drones, are able to talk to each other and to transfer signals between each other, signals which originate with the controllers back in Moscow. We also now have increasing numbers of Russian satellites over Ukraine, some of which undoubtedly are providing guidance capabilities. So the Russians' ability to coordinate these drone offensives are now increasing, and the Russians, of course, also have the ability to control these drones because so many more drone operators have now been recruited and trained. Drone operators conducting drone operations on the front lines, the Rubicon Group and others, for example, using FPV drones and drones of that kind. And whatever team it is based wherever it is, wherever in Russia it is, that is responsible for the use of the Geran drones in the strategic offensive that the Russians are now conducting against Ukraine in the sky. When you drill down and look at what the Western media is saying, the big narrative about the war at the moment, it is entirely about the much more primitive, much smaller in scale, Ukrainian drone attacks inside Russia. And I have to say, I've seen pictures of the drones that the Ukrainians are using, which are basically sort of adapted. Well, they look like aircraft, which enables them, admittedly, to go across significant distances, but by the way, makes them visible and vulnerable targets. But anyway, there is no comparison in terms of sophistication of Ukrainian drones with Russian in this on this issue. And the Ukrainians have no ability to conduct the kind of sophisticated attacks that the Russians are carrying out. And the scale of the Russian attacks is multiple times greater. And of course, the Ukrainian attacks are being made against a country, Russia, with a working air defense system, which is going to get more and more advanced and better at dealing with drones. And I noticed that the Russians are now talking about something they call the Donbass Dome, some kind of protection system that appears to have been established over Donbass, over the Donetsk and Luhansk republics. It's not at all clear to me how that works, and the Russians are not providing much detail. But the Russians have an air defense system, and it's now becoming increasingly clear that the Ukrainians increasingly don't. So I suspect that over the course of the summer, we are going to see a steady deterioration in the war in the sky. The Ukrainians have, as I've discussed, launched drone strikes against Russia, particularly northwest Russia, using NATO airspace, the Baltic states, Finland. The Russians have given a series of strong warnings about this. The Baltic states have been unnerved by Russian success in taking control of Ukrainian drones as they attempt to cross the airspace of the Baltic states. The Russians have then redirected the drones, the Ukrainian drones, so that they attack targets inside the Baltic states. The Finnish government seems to have been unnerved about this. They demanded that Ukraine stop doing this. And President Stubb, one of the most hardline figures in NATO, has suddenly discovered the virtue of talking to the Russians, though he shows no actual interest or plan to do so. And Estonia has said that this must stop, and Lithuania has said that this must stop. And in Latvia, this whole affair has precipitated a political crisis. The defense minister said that he was intensely relaxed about the Ukrainians using Latvian airspace for drone attacks on Russia, and that he wasn't going to take any action to stop it. That provoked an uproar in Latvia. The defense minister was forced by the Latvian prime minister to resign. The party to which the Latvian defense minister belongs took umbrage to this. That party has now quit the Latvian government coalition. The result is that the government itself has collapsed, and well, perhaps we're going to see elections in Latvia. Again, to repeat my core point, the Russians do enforce their red lines. This year, since the start of the new year, we have seen clear evidence of this, and one should not disregard or overlook this. The Russians not only enforce their red lines, but they are doing it effectively, and them doing so has played some role in the failure of the American-Israeli operation against Iran, with the results that we see. And, well, it's upset American business people because their interests in Ukraine are being attacked. And it's brought about the collapse of the government of Latvia. That isn't, of course, stopping some people in Europe from wanting to continue the war. Prime Minister Starmer of Britain, leader of a government that is now, it seems to me, in a process of political meltdown, just saying, with his own period as Prime Minister probably coming to an end. He still is working as hard as he can to get Britain to provide some of the funds needed to make good the 90 billion euro loan to Ukraine. So the British are still doing that. Mark Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO, now says that Europe needs to levy a tax, basically to help Ukraine. It needs, in other words, to divert, or every European member of NATO needs to divert a percentage of GDP, of its GDP, to supporting Ukraine. When I read this, by the way, I initially thought this was a joke. The idea that NATO would call on European member states to provide Zelensky, of all people, in the middle of an ongoing corruption scandal, with a percentage of their GDP, seemed to me too far-fetched, even for these times. Well, I should note that there is no contortion that European leaders, or at least some European leaders, will not go through, however bizarre and outlandish, in order to go on supporting Ukraine. So, well, that is what we see. There's been some talk of negotiations with the Russians, but of course nobody can agree on who the negotiator will be and what proposals should be brought to the table with the Russians. And of course, in the meantime, the war continues and the Russians continue to win. Now, I'm not going to discuss the details of the fighting today. There's been more news from Konstantinovka of Russian advances there. There appears to be a Russian breakthrough now with the fall of certain important settlements in eastern Zaporozhye. Whether, as I said, European leaders are familiar with any of this, I have no idea. But we are now in a situation where the Russians, like the Chinese, aren't taking the Americans seriously and aren't negotiating with them. And the Europeans talk about negotiations, but give the impression of not wanting to negotiate at all, even though they have no plan to end the war or to deliver victory or to achieve anything, actually. So there it is. We are in an extraordinary situation in international relations. Where all this is going to go, I'm really not sure. But for the moment, there's no sign of any resolution to the crisis in the Persian Gulf. There's no sign of an end to the war in Ukraine. The Chinese and the Russians appear to have largely given up on Donald Trump and his administration, and the Europeans, well, the least said about them, the better. So, on that bleak note, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.